It is 8:28, starting a few minutes early because the counterspin got cut off there. That was a technical glitch.
And thank goodness that the Leo Kotti song runs longer than 45 seconds. We weren't ready.
Yeah, I got a whole 3-CD set of Leo Kotti. We could have gone for, you know, into the next show. So, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Both looking very summery this morning.
That's because it's summer. Yeah. Solstice was a couple days ago.
Okay, yeah, I gathered that. I'm up on some things.
Good. Well, that's why we have you here,
for your relentless
knowledge of the
seasons.
The seasonal changes, yes. Just
call me the, yeah. Let's move on. We're broadcasting from the beautiful South Lake Union area, for those that aren't already familiar with that.
Yes, in a studio that has nothing to do with summer, I might add.
No, it doesn't.
That's why I brought my sweater.
Yeah. And, we have
meat hanging from the side of the
walls. We've always joked about how cold
here.
This room is. But anyway, so South Lake Union is an area that the city of Seattle, at least Greg Nichols, seems to believe that we can't transfer enough money over to here.
Yeah, and it turns out to be more and more and more money. Word broke this week that the price total for the amount of money that the city wants to spend on South Lake Union is now in excess of $1 billion, B with a billion dollars. That is money that is... covering not only infrastructure improvements, which is really only about a fifth of that total, but I thought I heard somebody laughing there.
No, I was just coughing.
Okay. But
$1 billion kind of got me.
It is kind of breathtaking. It covers not only the infrastructure improvements that we've heard about before, but we're talking about the trolley, we're talking about a new substation, we're talking also about an amount of money that's being negotiated by a local coalition of community groups that's trying to extract money for low-income housing, for various things to offset the impact of what will be a huge development in the South Lake Union area. Historically, developers have paid those kind of costs when entering into these kind of large developments like this. But it turns out that Greg Nichols is just saying, well, put that on our tab. And so the money is actually being borne by the taxpayers, being used, the councilmanic bonds is the term that's being used. It's basically a credit card that the city council would use in order to fund the low-income housing and some of these other improvements, and then presumably the revenue that the city gets from the economic development and the taxes that are or are not paid by Vulcan, by Paul Allen's company, would cover the costs of all this. That's the rationale that Nichols' office is using.
Well, and by the supposed companies that are going to move here to create this big biotech region.
Yeah,
and
of course the biggest problem with that is that you have at least six or seven areas just in the Puget Sound alone that are trying to develop to court the same few handful of companies.
Hundreds all over the country that are doing the same.
Yeah, exactly. But you have Renton, you have up in Bothell, you have all of these different industrial parks that are trying to develop for biotech. It's supposed to be the next big boom. And you have all of these different areas in the rest of the country as well, as Maria is saying.
And now, the biotech industry itself is not exactly a profitable industry, is it? There are a lot of been millions of dollars of venture capital poured into biotech that hasn't returned much profit.
You have very few companies so far it's a very high risk kind of venture. You have very few companies so far who've done well, and of course, you know, Vulcan is seeing this as an area where Paul Allen is flush with cash and can spend it on rockets or whatever he wants to. That he has some sort of a competitive advantage going in, that he can assume that kind of risk. But it's a lot easier risk to assume when the city is picking up so many of the costs. And that really is the nub here, because city council hasn't weighed in on this. These negotiations are taking place in secret. And we're just not getting very many details out of Greg Nichols or his office as to what's being essentially given away on the public's dime here.
Yeah, you'd think they would work out that billion-dollar transfer for the stadium, for Paul Allen first before we figured out about transferring any more money to him. But I guess let's just move along, you know. Is that Greg?
Well, no, that's the other part of downtown that Paul Allen has bought. That's the south side that's different.
Oh yeah,
that's separate
as opposed to city, as opposed to City Hall.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's where the two meet.
Exactly. Doing this pincer movement.
Yeah. Ouch. All right. Well, I think that's something we'll probably be revisiting.
No doubt. We're going to hear a lot more about this in the future.
All right.
And hopefully there will be some voices in City Hall. I know Nick Licata and Peter Steinbrück have been raising concerns about this, and hopefully we'll hear some more voices in City Council that want to take a closer look at how this is supposed to be funded and who's going to pick up the bill.
All right. Well, you bring us some surprising news about Velma Valoria.
Yeah, she is... has announced that she is not going to be running for re-election in her state district, District 11, in South Beacon Hill in the South Seattle area. She's been in office for a number of years now and is a strong progressive voice down in Olympia. But her husband is in Cambodia, and she's going to be moving there to join him. He's been working, organizing in sweatshops in Cambodia. So she's going to be moving there to join him, and we've got a couple people who have already announced that they're going to be running for Velma Valoria's seat, those being Bob Prinz and Bob Hasegawa, the former labor leader. So we'll see more of that, and I'm sure there'll be other people jumping into that race in the future. But for this moment, you know, Velma has served the community really well over the past number of years, and we wish her well in her new endeavors.
Mm. Well, that's too bad, but people like Bob Hasegawa, that's exciting. So
yeah, he's also a very strong and very very experienced progressive leader.
All right. Well, jumping then from local to national, understand there's some memos released from the White House this week. Anything juicy in that?
Well, that's job is a laugh
personal
track.
Personal laugh track.
No. Actually, the big news on the release of the memos, the Bush administration released a handful of memos that were relating to how the administration determined the treatment of Afghan prisoners of war and prisoners who were taken in the war on terrorism, meaning, you know, guys suspected of being al-Qaeda members, and also some memos relating to interrogation techniques that were approved for Guantanamo and other U.S. facilities. Now, the thing that actually played the most in the media on all this was that Bush had admitted in a memo that he wrote that he did have the authority as President of the United States to authorize torture. But in that same memo, he goes on to say, well, I won't do that right now. However, the thing that struck me about these memos, and I read through most of them, is that there was a lot missing. So these were very, very carefully selected. The most recent memo was dated April 16th of 2003. So, of course, there was nothing in there relating to Iraqi prisoners of war at all. And, of course, the Iraqi prisoner abuse scandal is what has led to the release of these memos in the first place. So, really, they're not an answer to the administration's critics at all. Another thing that struck me is that the overall tone of these memos is of people trying to figure out what is the most that they can get away with without triggering any kind of legal action against the Bush administration. So they're doing all these legal maneuverings to get away with doing torture but avoid the legal blame. And then what also struck me is that they even bring up the potential backlash against U.S. troops who are captured as prisoner of war. So they even mentioned that if we go ahead and call these guys captured in Afghanistan, if we call them unlawful combatants, that means that any U.S. soldiers who are captured by the enemy, they could do the same thing and torture our own troops. They bring that up in the memo. So they knew that it would happen or that it was likely to happen. However, they dismiss it by saying, well, we're legally in the right and they won't be legally in the right, so it's okay. So we'll just go ahead It's just insane. It is. I think it's criminal.
It's American exceptionalism again. You know, mm-hmm. our poop don't stink and all that. What was really striking to me about about these memos was, again, that they knew they were doing wrong. They knew that they, you know, you're dancing around with and trying to find the legalisms and parsing with the Geneva Conventions. You know, you're not, you don't walk a fine line, you know, around things like that. You try and err on the side of conservatism. You know, when you're messing around with something like the Geneva Conventions, which are specifically in place,
which are
so
very
that,
conservative themselves.
Which are very conservative themselves.
I mean, if you read the Geneva Conventions, now that's being tossed around a lot, especially George Bush keeps repeating, I said U.S. troops need to be treated according to the Geneva Conventions. He says that over and over again, so that people are starting to think, well, it's okay under the Geneva Conventions to strip prisoners naked. It's not okay.
No.
If you read the Geneva Conventions,
they're very, very clear.
And
there's
no
ambiguity.
And you compare that to the treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and other U.S. detention facilities, including Guantanamo, what we know of the treatment of prisoners there. If you compare the two, it's obvious we've violated many, many, many portions of the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, repeatedly and in spirit as well as deed. The Geneva Conventions are very clear. There's no room for ambiguity there, and what you've got is an exercise where lawyers are working in shifts trying to find the ambiguity in documents for which there really isn't much of any, and for which, you know, you're going to lose in the court of public opinion, and you're going to lose on the battlefield even if you're trying to parse these documents for ambiguity. As Maria said, it's insane. It's completely counterproductive, and it's also obviously a horrific violation of human rights.
Yeah, well, and it also leaves you with the idea that you're dealing with people in charge of our country who will do whatever they can to get away with whatever they want, and it's a very frightening idea after you start really looking at what they're saying in some of these memos, and you start thinking about, well, they're also talking about U.S. law here as well as international law. It's not just the Geneva Convention they're trying to get around. It's U.S. statutes on torture and
so
forth.
Yeah, and remember, one of the rationales, again, is that the president himself is above U.S. law. That actually is a rationale that has been laid out by this administration. It's very, very frightening stuff. This is how you slide down the slippery slope to dictatorship. This is how it happens.
All right, moving along. There's a lot of bills on the radar that.
Speaking of slippery slope,
yeah,
big surprise. Not a lot of them sound very positive.
Yeah, what we've got here is, if folks remember, about 18 months ago, we had a draft bill that was leaked by the Center for Public Integrity that was supposed to be the second coming of the Patriot Act. It was quickly dubbed Patriot 2, and it contained all sorts of reprehensible provisions. And the public outcry was immediate and overwhelming, so that that bill was never introduced. This was in January of 2003. Well, strangely enough, portions of that bill have been creeping back into the congressional record. It first happened this past December when we had the rider that was slipped into the last minute into the Intelligence Authorization Act, which allowed basically renamed any transaction in our economy a business, so that the FBI and the Justice Department could seize records of a business that supposedly had anything to do with terrorism. It just changed the definition of business. Now you have a number of additional bills that are a crop in the Congress, one of which is fairly close to passage. It's now in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The House Judiciary Committee, H.R. 3179, the Anti-Terrorism Intelligent Tools Improvement Act of 2003.
it's my turn for a laugh track.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. And all of these have ridiculous. Now to be distinguished from the Anti-Terrorism Tools Enhancement Act of 2003, which is a different one. And then we have We have also the Personal Detention and Lifetime Supervision of Terrorists Act of 2003. I'm not making these up. These are real pieces of legislation that are in Congress right now, which lift language directly from the Patriot Act, Patriot 2, that was shot down because of public outrage in early 2003. I have the full list of, replete with the Senate and House names and the titles of them and what they do and whatnot in Working for Change column, and it'll also be in the weekly next week. But these are pieces of legislation that it would be well to direct Senators Murray and Cantwell's and various area representatives attention to, and say, you know, these things need to not even be getting at a committee, let alone to a floor vote, because they once again, virtually all of them have to do with addressing penalties for crimes that were fairly hastily defined under the Patriot Act. They are once again eroding of the Fourth Amendment around search and seizure, and vastly expanding the tools that law enforcement has to use, in supposedly going after terrorists without having any probable cause. It's very, very frightening stuff.
All right. And can we expect a summary of that in this coming edition of Eat the State as well?
Yes, it will.
Okay. All right. Moving along. I was shocked, and I don't get shocked that well, you know, besides the therapy sessions. I was shocked to hear the U.S. back down on something this week.
Oh, yes. The U.N. Security Council basically dug in their heels and said, no, we will not renew immunity in front of the World Court for U.S. soldiers in peacekeeping missions. That was a major loss for the Bush administration. Now, they have negotiated immunity with the Iraqi government. The interim U.S.-appointed Iraqi government has negotiated immunity for U.S. troops there, so there won't be any prosecution of U.S. soldiers for example, you know, abusing Iraqi prisoners of war. But in other areas of the world, U.S. troops will now be subject to the International Criminal Court.
Which is something that the Bush administration has adamantly opposed from the get-go.
Oh, yes. And the interesting thing is that the Security Council basically dug in their heels over the Iraqi prisoner abuse scandal. They basically pointed a finger at the Bush administration and said, this is something that would come before the International Criminal Court if you didn't have immunity. And because the U.S. legal system is not dealing with it, we have to say no to immunity. That's basically what occurred in this. It was not a vote. Actually, the Bush administration backed down and didn't push it to a vote because they knew they didn't have people who would support it, and that most of the nations on the UN Security Council would abstain from the vote, and that would defeat the move.
Yeah, and when they're talking about the U.S. legal system not dealing with this issue, what they're talking about is all of this nonsense that we're hearing about, oh, it was a few bad apples and the scapegoating of a handful of service people, not dealing with the fact that this is obviously a systemic problem. That involved higher ups as well. That so far, anyway, we have not seen any movement within the U.S. legal system to bring higher people in the military or higher people in the political establishment to heal for what was obviously a fairly carefully coordinated strategy or policy of interrogations.
Yeah, and releasing a few documents relating to Guantanamo prisoners is not going to do the trick.
Yeah, yeah, we're talking about prosecutions here as what would be considered appropriate.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. Well, that then takes us to this week in Iraq.
Get ready for the biggest one-night event.
I love this lead-in.
This week in Iraq.
Okay, the security situation in Iraq once again deteriorated even further this week after a series of coordinated attacks. What you might call a widespread uprising in six cities across northern and central Iraq. Now, assaults by insurgents in the cities of Baghdad, Baquba, Ramadi, Mosul, Mahawil, and Fallujah were aimed primarily at government buildings and police stations. The Iraqi police forces, however, crumbled, absolutely crumbled. A lot of them abandoned their posts in the face of the attacks, and it was U.S. troops that were forced to bring in heavy weapons, including tanks, heavy artillery, and aerial bombardment with 500-pound bombs in order to stop the insurgents. Even then, the guerrillas proved tough and surprisingly difficult to defeat. In Bakuba, fighting raged from dawn until dusk, not just the couple of hours in early in the day that was reported in other cities. The guerrillas were well-equipped. They were highly coordinated, and according to a Washington Post reporter who interviewed U.S. troops in Bakuba, the insurgents showed a new level of strength and tactical skill that alarmed the soldiers facing them. By nightfall, U.S. troops had regained most of the buildings that were taken by the guerrillas, but the guerrillas had stormed two police stations in neighborhoods that are considered hostile and no-go areas for U.S. troops. And fighting continued on Friday and is continuing today in Bakuba over portions of the city. So it really is a major uprising going on here. It wasn't reported as such much in the U.S. media. Unless you were listening to NPR, then they reported it a little bit.
Can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
What I did find out interesting about U.S. coverage, at least on CBS, when they were talking about that uprising, was they started out the report with saying, you know, about the uprising, and that it had killed innocent civilians, which I found interesting that, oh, you know, when the U.S. is, like, doing an operation, boy, you never hear the term about killing civilians.
Innocent civilians, yeah.
But, boy, or as opposed to guilty civilians.
Yeah, or
come on.
Dropping bombs on buildings that are suspected of being guerrilla hideouts.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Well, if they're
and
not
gosh,
guerrilla
they pulled,
hideouts, what else might they be?
Yeah, you know? Gosh, they pulled, you know, the bodies of three children from the building, but, you know, you can't mention that on NBC or CBS or whatever.
Yeah, however, Iraqis themselves know it, which is why more and more of these forces are large and well-coordinated.
Yeah. Now, although the Lebanese terrorist group that is controlled by a guy named al-Zarqawi, you've probably heard his name quite a bit, claimed responsibility for the attacks, commanders on the ground in Bakuba said the insurgents fought using tactics of the former Iraqi army. Now, in Ramadi, the guerrillas did wear headbands that proclaimed their allegiance to al-Zarqawi's group, but in Fallujah, guerrillas released videotape of them telling the public that they had nothing to do with al-Zarqawi and that they are simply local insurgents trying to drive U.S. forces out of their city. However, in Mosul, 7 simultaneous car bombs killed more than 70 people. Car bombs have been associated in the past with Muslim fundamentalist groups like al-Zarqawi's. So there is some continuing evidence that it's not just it's not just locals in Fallujah, and it's not just former Ba'ath Party members, and it's not just members of the former military who are doing this, but they're
it's all of them.
Connected also to Muslim fundamentalists, some who are Iraqi Muslim fundamentalists and some who may be foreigners.
Yeah, and all of them are working together.
And they're working in coordination.
Which is the most scary part of all of this is that is that they are all working with one common goal, and that's to get the Americans out.
Yeah. Now, Ayad Alawi, the interim U.S.-appointed prime minister and a master car bomber himself, said that the Iraqi government may declare martial law after June 30th when it takes control. Now, in other words, that means now that Iraq has an interim constitution, it will immediately be suspended, is basically what he was saying. So Iraqis will not be able to avail themselves of their rights under this new interim constitution. Of course, Alawi is pretty much full of hot air because there is simply no way that the Iraqi government can enforce martial law at this time, because there simply are not enough reliable Iraqi security forces to carry out any kind of regular patrols in most portions of the country. Now, the Guardian of London reported this week that the Iraqi interim government has 120,000 cops on the payroll, but only 89,000 of them turn up for work on any given day. And more than half of these guys still have had no training, much less the equipment or even guns to carry out any kind of patrols. Of the new Iraqi army that's separate from the Iraqi police, there are only 5,000 soldiers who are in training. They're still in training. They're not even finished with their basic training yet. Now, the new security forces are lacking about 95% of the radios they need, 3/4 of the body armor they need, 2/3 of the vehicles to go out on patrol, and about half the guns they need to just do their jobs. So that's one of the main reasons why they tend to, well, you know, get up and leave when they see insurgents coming over the hill. And who can blame them? Now, it's become a common lament that Paul Bremer shouldn't have dissolved the Iraqi army last spring. That, gosh, if we'd only kept the Iraqi army in place, none of this would have happened. Folks tend to forget what an abrupt change that was from Bush administration policy, that the U.S. would go in and just remove the top civilian leadership of the Iraqi administration, and the lower levels of the administration would stay in place, and the Iraqi army would stay in place, etc. That was a very abrupt change when Bremer dismissed the Iraqi army. And it's become known now that it was Ahmed Chalabi who was instrumental in persuading Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Bremer to dismiss the Iraqi military. Now, Ahmed Chalabi, unfortunately, is not quite out of the picture yet. He, just before dissolving the Iraqi Governing Council, just before it dissolved itself, it passed a little-noticed edict that guaranteed the members of the Governing Council seats on the Interim National Council. That's the 100-member body that will advise Alawi's new government. It will approve the 2005 national budget, and it will pave the way for elections supposedly in January 2005. In addition, Chalabi and other exiles who've sat on the Governing Council will be prominent members of the Supreme Commission for the Preparation of the National Conference. That means they will be selecting the rest of the people to sit on the Interim National Council. Now, it was Paul Bremer and other coalition officials who actively pushed to have this happen. They wanted Ahmed Chalabi and these other people to sit on this Interim National Council. So we'll be hearing more from Mr. Chalabi in the future, I'm sure. We'll be hearing a lot more about him.
All right, very briefly, there was an article this week by Seymour Hersh, and you spotted some stuff in it.
Oh, yeah, the big thing about that article, everybody made a big deal about...
In the New Yorker.
Yeah, in the New Yorker. Everybody made a big deal about that article, about allegations that Israel was supporting the Kurds covertly. But apparently few people read to the end of the article, because there Hersh talks a lot about Ayed Alawi's past. In addition to being a terrorist car bomber responsible for massacring Iraqi school children, Dr. Alawi was, quote, a true believer in the Ba'ath Party and an ardent thuggish supporter of Saddam Hussein in the 1960s and 70s. Apparently, Alawi may not be a real doctor, since his medical degree was conferred upon him by the Ba'ath Party, according to one of his colleagues in London. Now, while in London in the early 70s, Alawi was in charge of the Mukhabarat, that's Iraqi intelligence. He was in charge of the Mukhabarat in Europe, and he was involved with a Mukhabarat hit squad who murdered Ba'ath Party dissenters living abroad in Europe. In about 1975 or 76, he abruptly fell from favor for reasons that he's never really discussed in any detail. So he has a very, very mysterious and strange past, and he just sounds a lot like somebody that we would support. In fact, one U.S. intelligence officer told Seymour Hersh, quote, two facts stand out about Alawi. One, he likes to think of himself as a man of ideas, and two, his strongest virtue is that he's a thug. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like anybody we know in U.S. politics?
I don't know. That doesn't narrow it down much.
Yeah. You're going to have to get some more hints than that.
Sounds a little bit to me like he and George Bush have something in common.
All right. Well, events this weekend.
Yeah, we got Gay Pride coming up tomorrow, 11 o'clock at Broadway and Pike. And, you know, bring your outrageous outfits. And then tomorrow night, Ralph Nader is speaking. Where is that again?
Kane Hall, 6 p.m.
So be there or, well, don't be there. Fahrenheit 9/11 is also opening this weekend to raving reviews.
Raving of one kind or another.
Exactly.
Depending on your viewpoints. And the corporation is still playing.
Yes.
So.
And it's
the
Control Room
is opening this weekend,
and that's an outstanding film, The Control Room. Highly recommend.
That's about a woman who wanted to become an embedded journalist during the war, but she became embedded with Al Jazeera. That's a very interesting film, and I highly recommend that.
Yeah, we saw that during the SIFF, and it was great.
All right. And Eat the State is still doing its fund drive.
We are. We are about halfway to our goal of $6,000, and we are hoping that our listeners, particularly listeners and readers who have never donated before, will get out their checkbooks and write us a check. And you can go to our website at www.eatthestate.org to make a donation with your credit card, or if you want to send us a check, it's P.O. Box, what, 85541,
that's it,
Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if you have any questions, comments, or tips, you can give us a call at 903-9461. Again, our address is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
And, of course, a great way of contributing to the fund drive as well as getting some back is just like a nice, you know, year, 2 year subscription.
Yeah. The subscriptions go for $24 for 1 year, $45 for two. Again, same address, P.O. Box 85541, Seattle 98145. And, you know, the same stuff that you see over the web, except you see it with comics and with graphics and with all the ads. And with
great Ted Rall comics, Tom Tomorrow comics.
And with you know, more material that we can fit onto the emails. So you're definitely getting more by beginning through the print.
Or more than we can fit into 30 minutes.
That's right. True, too.